Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Senate Education Committee to order. It is 3:45 p.m. here on Wednesday, March 4th. We are in the Belts Committee room here in the State Capitol Building in downtown snowy Juneau. I just want to ask the folks who are here in the room with us if they could please mute their cell phones. Documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members. They are also available on BASIS, and of course, additional copies are available for folks here in the room just right there by the door. Members present today is Senator Bjorkman, Senator Yump, myself, Senator Lukey Gail-Tobin. Please let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. I want to thank Kyla from the Juneau LIO for moderating today's meeting, and Mary Gwen, as always, for being with us today to document today's meeting for future posterity sake. All right, on the agenda today, we have a presentation from the University of Alaska about the College of Education Consortium, and we will also have our first hearing for Senate Bill 209 relating to high school graduation requirements and proficiency confirmation tools. We will be taking public testimony for Senate Bill 209. If you would like to provide public comments, please call one of the following numbers. From Anchorage, please call 907-563-9085. From Juneau, you may call 907-586-9085. From all other locales, the phone number to call that is toll-free is 1-844-586-9085. You can also testify from your local legislative information office, and you can submit your public testimony to senate.education@akleg.gov. That's senate.education@akleg.gov. Please let the record reflect we have been joined by Senator Keel. All right. On the first item today, we will hear a presentation from the University of Alaska about their College of Education Consortium. We are joined by the UA liaison for the College of Education, Bridget Weiss. We also have online today the following folks for questions or for also additional context. We are joined by the UAA School of Education Dean, Dr. Tanya Doucet. We also have the UAF College of Education Dean, Dr. Doug Cost, and we also have the UAS School of Education Interim Dean, Dr. Angela Lunda. We also have been joined by President Stevens. Welcome to the Senate Education Committee. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you would like.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I, for the record, am Dr. Bridget Weiss. I work for the University of Alaska, and I am the liaison to the Alaska College of Education Consortium. We do have our three deans online. If you, throughout this presentation, have a question that you would like to direct that that way. I'm here really to share an update of the variety of things that we are working on as a consortium with the investment and excitement of all three schools of education with the ultimate goal of developing high-quality educators for our K-12 school system, whether that be teachers or principals and reading specialists, et cetera. So this slide just shows a variety of things that we are doing. We are developing and implementing apprenticeship programs that are new to our country in the area of education within the last few years. We have EdRising. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. We have a statewide mentor project that's really working on retention, where every new teacher has the option to have a mentor to support them in their first couple of years. We also, the University of Alaska Anchorage, outside of the School of Education, just implemented a school psychology program, which is another area of very high need in our state to have in-person school psychologists working with our high needs population. And we have currently 15 students in that brand new program. So that's super exciting, fresh work that the university is doing. On this slide, I have contact information. I will apologize for a typographical error. That is Lunda. Angie Lunda is the interim dean, not a Y at the end of that. So I apologize for that. These are our current numbers, and I get asked very often, like, how can we get more teachers in front of kids in Alaska? And as a university, we are really taking that challenge to task and going at it from lots of different angles. But I thought it would help just to have these current numbers. In the last 5 years, this is initial licensure only. So if a existing teacher wants to go back and get their special education license, as an example, they're not counted in this. This is just the first initial licensure for people, and we're at 662 in the last 5 years. It is not a capacity issue. We have capacity, you know, and we are constantly doing outreach, looking for people. The registered apprenticeship program is an example where we are looking within communities for new teacher candidates and how we can support them. And you're going to hear about a couple of those initiatives today. Some highlights. University of Alaska Fairbanks, fall enrollment in the School of Education in all programs is up from this fall of this year to anticipated fall 2026. We look like we're up 85 students. That's just celebration. University of Alaska Southeast is developing a Master's of Arts in Teaching Indigenous Languages. This is a really big support for our people in the state who are teaching language for our students, where they can be certified, and that helps them. They can move on a salary schedule, often different when they are certified. It also prepares them in a new and different way for the classroom, which is a little different than being a language expert without the teaching aspect. So we're really excited about that program that is in process of approval right now. University of Alaska Anchorage is what we would consider deep into the implementation of registered apprenticeship programs. This is the third year. We actually went to a national registered apprenticeship program conference a couple months ago, and it was pretty invigorating because we were ahead of the game. It really felt good. The Alaska representatives that were there and the department was there, all three schools of education had representation, and we are in it. And we're not behind the game. We really, it felt good to know that this new initiative, we were entering into that very expertly and solidly with good practice. And that was very affirming while we were there. In fact, UAS, the number of apprentices they have, account for 2% of all apprenticeships across the state in the area of education. So I think that is, we're getting more traction than we even thought when we started these programs. And our first licensed teacher will graduate in May from the registered apprenticeship program in pretty short order. Lastly, on this highlight, UAF School of Education also entered into registered apprenticeship this year, and they have elementary, secondary, and special education programs, candidates working right now in those brand new apprenticeship programs this year, and with the numbers that are there. One of the questions that Senator Tobin asked was a little information on PETAs, which stands for Preparing Indigenous Teachers and Administrators for Alaska Schools. And so I have some numbers here. I won't read all of those to you, but you can see that we have this program has impacted Indigenous learning and environments in our state. And it is one that Southeast Alaska should be really proud of. And this is continuing the way now with current 13 students, and 3 will graduate this spring. And this is, I think, complements all the other work we do very nicely to prepare Indigenous teachers to be prepared for classrooms and get engaged in our with our students. Last week, just this past weekend, a couple days ago, I was in Fairbanks and University of Alaska, UAF School of Education held a Grow Your Own event. And we really have two. Growing our own really can be done multiple ways. Registered apprenticeship is a Grow Your Own program. It's just defined by the federal government through the DOL, and that sort of frames that work. But alongside that, we also have other Grow Your Own partnerships with districts that are less rigid, a different model than that. And we had 15 school districts in Fairbanks over the weekend. The faculty and staff at the UAF School of Education did an amazing job presenting lots of different ways that school districts can partner with the university, all the way from pathways to funding, how students can get scholarship funding, and so forth. So it was it's a grassroots kind of conversation, and it was really exciting to have 15 districts there. And it was a roll up your sleeves time where districts could ask questions and say, okay, we have paraprofessionals that are doing this. They're interested. How do we get them started? And really starting to design. And so that was really very impressive. Early childhood is also a high need in our state. And so we have a couple different ways that we get at early childhood as the university. One is through the CTC program in Fairbanks that is housed under University of Alaska Fairbanks. And then UAA School of Education has also taken this on through their RAP program and had really, really high response numbers. And so that is very exciting. It's stackable, so somebody can just start it and say, gosh, I think I just want my certificate. I want to be able to go work for a daycare, maybe make a little more money because I have this certificate and I'm really prepared. Then they get in there, they go, ooh, this is kind of cool. Maybe I want to go get my AAS. And so they can continue and get their associates, which of course then could lead to the bachelor's, where they could be then a certified teacher in our K-12 classrooms. These programs are accredited. University of Alaska Anchorage, for their initial licensure programs, has provisional licensure through the Department of Education, and the Department of Education is supporting that and overseeing that until the year 27-28, right in there. Then UAA will go through the CAPE accreditation process. Again, it takes 7 years for that full cycle to go through, and then they will have their full CAPE accreditation at that time, which we're coming up to very quickly, it seems. So we are definitely contributing here. You'll see that we have 41 participating in the registered apprenticeship for the bachelor's program pre-K to 3. So that's a really nice number. And again, this program is young. We're in year 3. So I do think that this is one of these programs that in 5 years from now is going to look a little different than it does today. It's going to keep evolving as we go. But it's very exciting work. Our education leadership program also has apprenticeships. University of Alaska Anchorage has one that is just launching. And University of Alaska Southeast has one that is in the approval process right now and will target emergency certificate administrators particularly. And so we have, I used to know that number in the state. I'm not going to guess since we're on the record, but there is a pretty good number of administrators that are leading schools with an emergency administration certificate, and this program will swallow them up, support them as they're doing that work to get them certified and prepared for those positions. Both of these are supported through the Department of Education SAFE grant. One of our challenges with these programs as we go is sustainability of funding, because the advantages of one of the advantages, there's many, of apprenticeship programs is that participants are not paying for tuition, and so that takes some of that edge off. As we go, we're going to have to figure out how to sustain that. Speaking of money, one of the programs we are really proud of is our intern scholarship program. We support third and fourth year education students who are attaining their initial licensure and a grad student that's attaining their initial licensure. And in the last 4 years, we've given away $4 million to students. This current year, $1.3 million to about 95 students. We have paid tuition, fees, and while they do their internship, a living stipend of $5,000 per semester so that they can concentrate on preparing to be that high-quality teacher and not worry how they're going to get groceries on the table, pay for childcare, et cetera. So this is a super successful program. This is a funding commitment of the University of Alaska. President Pitney takes the commitment to the workforce in Alaska very seriously, and she is highly committed to education being one of those critical workforce needs that we have, and this is where we have really put the money where the mouth is. And it's the notes that I get from students. I have the privilege of facilitating this, and it is so meaningful to students to have this kind of support as they close up their bachelor's or their graduate program. Almost there. Educators Rising is one of our other huge successes. So when we think about how do we generate more teachers, we have to look at pipelines. We know that inside our rural communities is one place, taking people who live in those communities, who have an interest, and supporting them to stay in their communities while they get their education and become a teacher. Another pipeline is our high school students. When I was in high school, I knew I wanted to teach. I had a few other ideas, but I really wanted to teach. Getting into high schools and high school students getting excited about teaching as a career is one huge pipeline that we were sort of underutilizing, I feel, recently. But our Educators Rising program is on fire. Last year, we had 118 students across the state participating. This year, we have 312. That is a growth of 73% in the number of high school students that are engaged. Not all of these students will become teachers, but I guarantee you they will all become leaders in our state. In some workforce lane, these students are getting great experience, great exposure, and many of them will become teachers. And they, Ed Rising just had their conference on the tail end of the GYO meeting this week in Fairbanks, and the energy was palpable, and it was really rewarding to see these young people so taking initiative, showing leadership, excited to be together, learning a lot about education as a field, how to get there, how to fund that, et cetera. It was really, really energizing. So this is one of these that I think is could really help tip us in the right direction alongside our other programs. So with that, I would answer whatever questions you might have.
Well, thank you, Dr. Weiss. Are there any questions? President Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And congratulations. It's Dr. Weiss,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Congratulations on all you've done. I mean, we've been following this for many, many years, and we had a lot of problems early on, and we still have problems in finding teachers and hiring teachers. I really appreciate the Educators Rising program, mm-hmm. the fact that you are reaching people who will make great teachers. They just need to have a push.
Mm-hmm.
But just to go back to something that I know is all of a bit of an embarrassment, where are we on accreditation of the University of Alaska Anchorage?
Yes, thank you. The accreditation for the School of Education that was ceased at that time, it was initial licensure only, so that it was one program. The other programs are all still intact in terms of accreditation. The accreditation that was lost was called CAPE accreditation, and what has happened since then is the Department of Education from the state has stepped in and become provisional oversight for that program, and so we can have graduates there that come out with their initial licensure under the oversight of the department. At the same time, the University of Alaska of Anchorage School of Education has really nurtured all these programs to attract folks, students, and worked on their CAPE accreditation. It is literally a 7-year process to build up. And normally what happens is UAS just this past fall went through accreditation the spring before UAF did, and you go through that process and you attain your 7-year accreditation, and then you literally start over the next day winding through the cycle to do that again in 7 years. UAA is going to be there in 2027, 2028, when they will be able to have go through the final stages of that CAPE accreditation. And I have full confidence they will be accredited at that time. It would be really, really surprising. They've done all the right things. They're on track. There's a lot of steps and stages to get there. And so that's when that will occur for UAA.
That's great to hear. It's a long process, and really appreciate hearing what the university is doing right now. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, President Stephen. Any additional questions? I do have a question, and it might be best for Dr. Kost or maybe Dr. Lunda. I have heard from some folks who are nearing the end of their education and preparing to take their praxis, that they have been struggling to really take this final examination, and that we know that there's data about some of the aspects of why achieving proficient scores on praxis might not be attainable for certain groups of people. Can you give us any information about your support of students who are trying to take their praxis exam, or any insight or thoughts for consideration on this committee for those students?
I'm not sure. Is he still on? Because I can also respond to that.
I do see him still here with us. Dr. Kost?
Yes, we do have struggles around the praxis exam, and it unfortunately affects small percentages of our program graduates. Bridget can speak a little bit about how she's supporting a praxis preparation program across all three schools of ed that we recently had a look at. We also do individual courses as the need arises with small cohorts of those students to some success. But we are really looking with DEED at different ways that we can better support praxis preparation so that we can get our students across that finish line when they've done so much work to become excellent educators in our programs.
Thank you. Yes, I would just add to that that one of the things we learned when we were at that registered apprenticeship national conference was a tool. We'd been looking at tools, but we found a tool that we really like. It has a lot of different modalities to it, and so I'm working on purchasing that for all three schools of education, and it'll be like teacher candidates, praxis candidates this spring. In a matter of probably 2 weeks, we'll be using a variety of the tools that are available in this package. We're super excited about that. And as Dr. Kost said, we are also working closely with DEED around what that looks like for our students. We really, anytime you have a challenge, and we have a challenge, right, in Alaska, unlike or similar to many other states, we don't have enough teachers. So one concept or one strategy is developing pathways. How do we get more? But the flip side of that you have to examine and dissect is, what are the obstacles? Why isn't this, why don't we have more? Or what are the obstacles that people have when they're trying to become a teacher? And so we've done that. We've looked at both of those lanes. Funding and the praxis are two of the key places that are obstacles. So we're doing what we can to remove those obstacles.
Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weiss. My question is in regarding the praxis and what kind of praxis test are folks having trouble with? Mm-hmm. Could you talk to the committee, please, about the different types of tests, the Praxis 1 and then the different types of Praxis 2 tests, mm-hmm. and then which assessments are giving people problems?
There are, through the chair, sorry, I did not do that earlier. I apologize. I'm a little out of practice. So through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, the core praxis tends to be the one, reading, writing, math, that's what we call Praxis 1, is the one that trips most candidates that are going to get tripped. That's the one. Preparation program can do lots of different areas of the praxis, but it will focus on the core practice mostly for us. And it is pretty, you can find the rates of passage. We've also looked at our cut scores, they are in some areas, they are higher than other states. So we're sort of looking at it from a lot. We don't have control over that, obviously, but we're looking at that and to see the department is looking to see if our cut scores are good or if they should be adjusted. While we also work on preparing them. But the core praxis tends to be, and any of the deans can jump in if they see that differently, but from my understanding, it's the core praxis that tends to be the bigger stumbling block.
Could you
follow up?
Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you, through the chair, to Dr. Weiss. Could you talk a little bit more about at what point in the secondary education or post-secondary mm-hmm. education process do students take that Praxis 1 equivalent test, and what is that tool supposed to be used for?
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, I'm going to turn that over to any of the deans that would like to jump in. From my understanding, they can take it at any time through the course of their degree. They don't have to wait till the end. They can take it earlier. And there are a few alternatives to that praxis. But is there a dean that wants to speak to that? Tanya, maybe?
For the record, Dr. Tanya, did you say Dean for the School of Education at UAA, through the chair to Senator Bjorkman. For all three of us, the timing might be different. At UAA, we actually have tried to scaffold this into the preparation and the gateways that our candidates have to pass through for their quality checks. So by the time they reach their midpoint practicum, at the end of their second year in the program, if they were to be enrolled full time, we are working with them on that praxis prep support. So with subscribing to the passages preparation tool that Dr. Weiss was just referencing, while the students are enrolled in their practicum seminar, they would be engaging with that passages preparation tool to take practice test questions, to dive deeper and get remediation in a particular subject area. And then by the end of the semester, we're working with them to make sure that they've registered and taken it. That still gives them a year before we're looking at their internship to get that exam passed if we need to take that time. And then again, as we're heading into the internship, we're working with them so that in the fall of their internship, they're completing that praxis too, so that we don't have issues in May with completing their recommendations for deed.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Dusay. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you. Just have a comment and maybe you can get back to the committee with questions. It's been 20 years or so since I completed my teacher preparation training, but my experience and then many of my friends of the same age who went to similar programs, their experience was the Praxis 1 test was pretty basic. Mm-hmm. And we all had to pass a Praxis 1 before we got accepted into a teacher education program. Mm-hmm. And that test really measured, I would say, a level of knowledge that would have been maybe high school graduation or below, mm-hmm. I think, if I recall correctly. So I'd be interested to know if that was the feeling that you as deans have as far as what level of knowledge is expected on a Praxis 1 or similar test. So I'm certainly interested to learn more, and if our cut scores or our tool is out of whack. I know in another state that I'm familiar with, they adjusted their basic skills test and threw it way out of whack, and mm-hmm. it became very, very hard.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know more about that.
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, I will get you some additional information on the praxis for sure. I can also include our passage rates in that, so you can see that as well as the cut scores compared to other states.
Thank you, Dr. Weiss. President Stevens.
Just a quick question. I appreciate your comment on focusing on school psychologists. What does that entail? Do school psychologists just graduate from college, had to have a master's, a graduate degree? How does that work?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the school psych, and we do have, this is not a school of education program, so I'm not an expert on the program itself. However, it is a master's program, and it is a specifically designed program to support the work that psychologists do in schools, which is heavily support the special education process. They do a lot of assessment and designing of programming to support the special education team as they develop individualized educational programs for students.
Well, thank you. I certainly understand that assessment.
And
is
it's
really
the first in the state. We have not right. had this program, excuse me, we have not had this program in the state before this, and so having one in state, the teachers who are participating, I know two of them from Juneau that are doing that, are just so excited to have this opportunity and be able to do it right here in Alaska.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, President Stevens. And I believe that new program was approved this last October. Is that correct?
Yes, I think it was October.
Excellent. Well, seeing no other questions from the committee, we want to thank you all for joining us here and updating us on the excellent work that is happening within our School of Education Consortium at the University of Alaska campus. We will take a very brief at ease as we transition to our next item on the agenda. Brief at ease. And we're back on the record here in Senate Education. It is 4:16 p.m. on Wednesday, March 4th. We are joined by Senator Bjorkman, who is sponsoring Senate Bill 209. He is also here with his legislative aide, Matthew Churchill, to introduce the bill. Senator Bjorkman, if you could please identify yourself for the record and introduce your legislation.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Senator Jesse Bjorkman, and I represent the northern and central portions of the Kenai Peninsula. I greatly appreciate you all hearing this bill today, and I'm excited to tell you about what the genesis of the idea was, as well as how the state of Alaska compares to other states in our nation in measuring college and career readiness as students leave high school. So we'll talk a little bit about all of those things. We'll talk about motivation of students, and we'll talk about signaling to a student, their family, and the public what a student should be able to know, understand, and be able to do when they leave high school. I hope we can agree that students who graduate high school should have a certain level of knowledge in many respects. We have pretty thick documentation of what students are required to learn when they're in our schools. I printed off just today before I came down, really hot off the press, what I would be teaching as a high school social studies teacher for standards. It's this packet of paper. This packet of paper is very, very dense with knowledge and standards that would be taught over the course of 3 to 4 years of social studies curriculum from 9th to 10th grade. And it's exciting. It's exciting to explore those standards and think about all of the really neat conversations and themes and information that could be talked about in a classroom. Currently, well, where we're at, however, there is no kind of universal way to measure how students are proficient upon graduation they are. And that is, I think, a point of interest, and certainly not necessarily a point of grave concern, as students are required to take courses and earn credit. But as you see in the slide before you, 42 other states in the District of Columbia have some level of measurement, a college and career ready indicator. I would argue that some of those indicators are much more tailored and designed to fit the nature of that state. One of the Dakotas has an amazing system that they have come up with that really, I would say, matches the culture and character of their state. And others simply employ an ACT score or an ACT work keys or an ASVAB score as their measurement indicator. The bill before you proposes simply a measurement of how well students know and understand and are able to perform up to the standards that our state is expecting kids to learn and teachers deliver. One of the things that I think also is challenging about being in a classroom and motivating students, either from a position as instructor or teacher, but also as parent, is having measurable achievement, so that you can set goals and then encourage a student to achieve those goals by having something that's measurable. This bill would allow students to track their achievement over time. And then also a large problem that this legislation seeks to address is many in the public, they are leery and sometimes wary about hearing public school funding needs because they don't know and they do not trust the ability of our public schools to produce knowledgeable graduates. I would say that they can be educated and helped to understand that our public schools do produce some excellent graduates, and by far and away the majority of them are very capable. However, we have room for improvement, and this bill would direct that as well. So the solutions that this bill prescribes and offers as possibilities to be part of a college and career-ready measure would be a confirmation of learning. The confirmation of learning seen in this bill we'll talk more about, but it simply is a directionality that is included in the spring AK STAR test, that same testing window. This is not a new test. This is not a new period of time that districts would have to implement. They are already giving a test in the spring that is supposed to measure where kids are at a point in time so that they can, or essentially the public, receive feedback on schools. This, I think, is where we can improve and how we measure student learning so that it is much more meaningful to students themselves, their families, and the public at large. If we do this correctly, Madam Chair, I strongly believe that kids will look at their results on these measurements, and it could be an assessment or a portfolio review, and they can measure their own growth, their own learning in a scale that they can understand. The portion of this bill that increases graduation credit requirements seeks to more closely align our graduation requirements with our content standards. I held up just briefly just a portion of those content standards for one subject. Those content standards are deep and they're very high. And so we have our content standards that are at a very high level. Our graduation requirements for the purpose of earning credit in order to graduate, they're at a much lower level. I would say when we look at the rest of the country, our graduation requirements, specifically the prescribed number of 13 out of 21, are pretty low. And that's okay. It provides for a lot of flexibility. However, I believe that we can do a lot better if we set our goals a little bit higher, especially in math, science, and social studies, as you have done, Mr. President, with your civics bill, which I'm proud to support. As we go forward, then, setting goals is an amazing part of motivating students to achieve a higher level. I can tell you that when I began to have my students set goals for themselves every week, or I'm sorry, set goals for themselves every quarter, and they assess them every week, they were able to grow. They saw themselves growing. They saw themselves making progress or taking a little bit of time to do better every week by taking measurable action. And that's what this bill intends to do, is to measure progress over time so that they can achieve a seal of certified proficiency on their diploma when they graduate. So we talked a little bit about academically motivating students. What I want to spend a little bit of time talking about now is collective teacher efficacy. An educational researcher by the name of John Hattie did a pretty amazing body of work. He's since passed, but he's got many videos out and done great work, and his probably best book is a book called Visible Learning. And he studied the effect size that teachers could have on improving the growth of their students year to year. And the biggest thing that he talked about as far as improving student learning was this thing called collective teacher efficacy. It's when teachers work together effectively in teams to move their students toward an academic goal. Gaining proficiency in the standards and working together to help students individually and corporately to achieve proficiency and have a tangible goal measured on a scale that students can understand with that seal at the end of the process, I believe that it can really enhance collective teacher efficacy. and growing those students in the habits of mind needed to achieve that level of proficiency, it can be a very powerful tool. Also, again, this bill is designed through the ability to earn a seal of certified proficiency on a diploma when students achieve proficiency to have that extrinsic motivator that communicates to all stakeholders where kids are at. And again, this is a measure that our state does not have in any meaningful way right now. We used to employ the high school qualifying exam, but it has been not in place for about 12 years. I worked with many students in my early years of teaching in this state to help them study and to help them be prepared so that they could pass the high school qualifying exam. It was required that they pass that in order to graduate and get a diploma. This bill does not do that. This bill does not take away any student's ability to get a diploma. It simply offers a credential, a seal of certified proficiency when students show that they are proficient, either by a portfolio review or an assessment tool. Again, very similar to tools that are already being utilized. So what does it do? I've kind of talked about it a little bit, but this kind of puts it in terms that are easy to understand and read as far as graduation requirements. The current requirements you see there on the left, broken down by subject, again, that prescribed level at 13. The other requirements are on the right with a total prescribed level at 16, adding a credit in math, a credit in civics, and one whole credit, or half credit each of civics, and then economics or personal finance, and then one credit in science. One of the items in your packet is the specified credits needed to earn Alaska Performance Scholarship. These new credits under Senate Bill 209 would still be below the requirements for that APS scholarship, but they are, again, more in alignment with the performance standards that are required to be taught and then learned in the high school level. Also, when schools offer 7 credits per year, so that would be 7 periods per day typically, that would mean that the total required credits would move up to 24. One thing that happens oftentimes in schools now who offer 7 credits, but their required credits remain at 21, many students will gain all of their total number of credits needed to graduate by the end of their junior year. This signals to them that they are done and that they should get to graduate and move on. However, I would argue that there is a lot left that can be and should be learned and is very valuable for those students, not just for themselves and their grade, but also the other underclassmen in school buildings, that they are an essential part of the educational culture in the school. And there are many more things that can be learned there at that senior level, the 12th grade level. That's why you see that adjustment from 21 to 24. We talked a little bit about that, just a reminder of why we're adjusting those graduation requirements, because we do lag behind our performance standards and what we expect kids to earn credits in versus what we are expecting them to know according to the standards. We just kind of have a misalignment. One reason for that, I think, more than 10 years ago now, all of our state standards between, I think, 2011 through 2014, our state standards were all rewritten very significantly and made much more rigorous, as we've heard here in this committee a couple of times. When those state standards were rewritten and made more rigorous, graduation requirements did not increase correspondingly. I talked about this briefly, but the other part, aside from more closely aligning graduation requirements to standards, is, again, this optional opportunity to show academic growth and achievement through some kind of proficiency confirmation tool. It can be done at the same time that we are already doing tests. The only group of students that would have to take an assessment or submit a portfolio that are currently not are those group of 12th grade students who would take an additional summative assessment to earn that seal of certified proficiency. Once again, this is not a new test for anyone, but that one group of students. Those assessments are already being given. The confirmation tools, what are they? I've talked a little bit about them already, but again, it's measuring that progress level at 8th, 10th, and 12th grade so that students can track their growth. What they are not, they're not end-of-course assessments. The fiscal note produced talks a little bit about those end-of-course assessments. That is a conversation that I had with Commissioner Bishop when I was formulating this bill, that indeed many of those end-of-course assessments do exist already. And some of the material in them could be adapted for the purposes of these confirmation tools, but they're not the same thing. A confirmation tool, again, would be a grade-appropriate assessment either in the 8th, 10th, or 12th grade level to measure the learning that those students should have made, the learning progress that they should have made at that year. All of these assessments are retakeable. If students don't do well, if they need to show growth, if they need to go and get some proof of practice in and then take the assessment again, they have that opportunity. One other thing I'd like to point out before we end, I believe that the fiscal note talks about needing to develop some economic standards. Maybe that's a little bit old. Once again, I just printed off their draft standards just today. The new economic standards are found on page 101 to 104 of the draft social studies standards. So I think we got that covered.
Thank you.
I just saved you lots of money right there.
thank you, Senator Bjorkman. We'll move to a very quick, brief sectional analysis before we open it up for questions.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair Tobin. For the record, Matt Churchill. I'm Senator Bjorkman's staff. So Section 1 states a legislative intent that students graduating from a public high school in the state have demonstrated proficiency in the courses and subject areas required for graduation. Section 2 amends AS 1403-075E by adding a definition of social studies for the purposes of statewide performance standards and proficiency confirmation tools. The term social studies is defined to include civics, United States history, and Alaska history. Section 3 amends AS 1403-075 by adding a new subsections, F through I, requiring the Department of Education and Early Development to adopt statewide performance standards for grades 8, 10, and 12 in economics, science, and social studies, develop proficiency confirmation tools aligned with those standards for grades 8, 10, and 12 in economics, language, arts, mathematics, science, and social studies. We require school districts to administer the proficiency confirmation tools and require school districts to place a seal of certified proficiency on a student's diploma if the student meets graduation requirements and demonstrates proficiency on the grade 12 confirmation tools in all subject areas. Also requires districts to reassess students upon request if they did not initially demonstrate proficiency. Currently, DEED has already developed performance standards and under their authority found in AS 1407-020 and 1407-060, Section 3 specifies that the content area standards to be developed and then student achievement of them is measured. Section 4 amends AS 1403 by adding a new section, AS 1403-076, establishing a minimum statewide high school graduation requirements. A district must adopt a graduation plan that includes at least 21 credits in a 6-credit-per-year program or 24 credits in a 7-credit-per-year program. Minimum credit requirements would be 4 credits in language arts, as shown in the slides. Sorry. 4 credits in social studies, which is an increase of 1 credit. Credit in U.S. history, 0.5 credit in Alaska history, 0.5 credit in civics, and 0.5 credit in economics. 4 credits in mathematics, which is an increase of 1 credit. 3 credits in science, an increase of 1 credit. 1 credit in health and physical education. Authority for the district to waive certain subject area requirements for transfer students who have earned at least 13 credits elsewhere, and a definition of unit of credit. The reason the increase in credit specification is proposed is that the amount of credits required to graduate more closely align with the state's content area standards that students are expected to achieve proficiency in. And finally, Section 5 provides a seal of proficiency requirements. I apologize. And new graduation requirements apply to students graduating on or after January 1st, 2030.
Thank you. Thank you for that analysis. Are there questions from committee members? Senator, President Stevens.
Well, this makes great sense. It truly does. You know, as I've had a chance to talk to students, I'm always impressed with how advanced these young people are and how you know they're going to do well in life. But as you say, there's always room for improvement. One thing that's always bothered me, though, is that the idea of unfunded mandates. I mean, we're giving the schools the second largest budgetary item in our budget. First is a dividend. The second is education, K through 12. And yet, whenever we do something or suggest something, it always comes back as an unfunded mandate that you're not giving us the money to do that. We are giving them money to do it. That should be clear. I guess the high school qualifying exam we tried that and that seemed to raise a lot of hackles and people just hated it. So probably best not to have that. But anyway, I think your comment about seniors. I mean, I talk to a lot of kids who it seems like they see the senior year as a chance to just coast. They've done all the work in the first 3 years, and now they're just coasting. If you have goals and if you worked it out with them and they know what the goals are, that last year can be just more advantageous than anything they've done before. So thank you for presenting this.
Thank you. Thank you, President Stevens. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of questions show my lack of knowledge here. When we talk about these progress tests, these not year-end assessments, despite what the fiscal note might say, tell me what kind of test we're talking about. Is this something a student's going to sit in the back of the classroom and take on an iPad? Is this the kind of thing where the whole grade goes to the library and it's carefully proctored? What do we envision here?
Thank you for the question, Senator Keel, through the chair. The types of confirmation tools that could be employed here, again, could be an assessment tool very similar to the current AK Star test. So that test is given to students typically over the course of 3 days. The testing periods are anywhere from about 40 minutes to sometimes an hour and 20 minutes or so, depending on the type of test. Most districts, I believe almost all districts, and someone can correct me, but they take those assessments on computers. The MATSU held out and tried for paper tests for a couple of years, but I believe that they have transitioned now to computer-based assessments. Because the paper assessments costs significantly more money to handle and administer. The assessments, they're taken as a class. They're typically proctored by a certified teacher. A certified teacher has to essentially sign a blood oath that they will keep the test safe and follow all the rules, or they could lose their teaching certificate. It's kind of a whole thing. So to avoid cheating on the test, because, of course, this all becomes necessary because people find very inventive ways to be dishonest and they make national headlines. Thankful that hasn't happened here. But that's really how the assessment could be carried out, or students would have an option to present a portfolio to show that they have met the standards.
Senator Bjorkman, if you could identify yourself.
My apologies. For the record, Jesse Bjorkman, District D.
Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you. That's helpful. So can you then, Senator, help help me sort of put these new assessments you're looking for in the arc of the other assessments we require. We think kindergartners get a little pre-reading thing. That's not this big a deal. But then we do other elementary. Help me sort of get the whole picture here.
Yes, perfect. That's a great question. Because this line of confirmation tools completes the arc. Right now, the arc is kind of a bridge, like a cliff that you would see in Wile E. Coyote. So it kind of sticks out, and then after about 10th grade, there's nothing. There's no assessment tool. There's nothing really that takes place that gives data back to a school or the public about how those students are doing. However, that's really not the most important thing for me as I look at this piece of legislation. The most important thing, if we execute this properly, should be that assessment in 8th, 10th, and 12th grade, it becomes meaningful for a student because it's measured on a scale that students understand, because it's going to mean something to them to earn their proficiency seal later on. Currently, how this happens is that the AK Star test is completely external to a student's understanding of what they've learned, those results. They have no bearing on how a student kind of has any kind of metacognition or thinking about what have I learned. That score isn't a number on a scale that doesn't mean anything to them. They just pop up on a result for a school and are used to judge a school and often punish a school to say, oh, this school isn't doing very well. We need to look down on them or they need additional support. That is not this. This test to complete the arc, they would in 8th grade pick up this test that becomes meaningful to them personally because they can earn a seal of certified proficiency. I would like this test to be delivered on a 1 through 100 scale, something that students already understand as far as a percent of 100 and a grade level, so they know how they're doing. And then we have a cut score of proficiency that makes sense for students. We heard in this committee a couple of years ago when cut scores were adjusted for the AK Star test that the target in setting those cut scores was around the 67th percentile. From the commissioner, she told us that they set the cut score knowing that 2/3 of all Alaska kids would not be proficient. I think we should probably look at that when we look at the cut scores for these tests. I think that's something that we should have input and some direction on. But as far as the arc of testing, students start, they're taking those AK Star tests. The problem is the results don't come in until months after, and they're not informing kids about what they're learning. They're not informing kids about how they can grow as a student in future years. If we do this right, we can actually inform student learning so that a student knows what they need to know, understand, and be able to do to achieve proficiency. And it's not this very external, ethereal score that the kids don't even care about because it doesn't affect their life in a tangible way. I hope that answers your question.
Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Yunt.
Yeah, well, through the chair, fantastic news. One of the questions I was going to ask already did get asked. So couple comments and questions. First of all, thank you. This is a tough conversation to start. Some are going to love it and some are going to hate it. We went through this about 5 years ago at home at the Mat-Su Borough, and our school board did make it harder and more difficult to graduate, right? And there was some pushback, and the results are clear. 5 years later, U.S. News, they track about 24,000 high schools. They actually rank by name the top 75%. 5 years ago, we only had 3 of our high schools above national average. Today, we have 8. We were somewhere between 15 and 18% of our kids every year who would qualify for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. Last year, we hit 63% of our graduates qualified for that. And to me, that's what it's about. Like, graduating high school should not be super easy. Shouldn't be super difficult either, but it shouldn't be so easy that anybody can do it with no effort and you can just walk out in 2.5, 3 years. So goal number one, make sure that when they graduate that there's a certain standard that they can reach. Goal number two is how do we keep our kids home? Well, you keep them home by helping them qualify for the Alaska Performance Scholarship, right? And almost two-thirds of our kids last year did qualify for that. So great job. You touched on earlier how long it takes to get the AK Star results back. It is brutal. How do we fix that? I don't know, and you guys can help me with that. I don't know what the answer is to that, right? But I would love to know more about that. And then how long your proficiency, test, whatever, that do you have an idea how long it would take for us to get the results back on that? Because I feel like for it to really make an impact in that child's life so they have time to overcome it if they don't do well enough, it needs to be almost instant, right? So thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Jesse Bjorkman, Senate District D, through the chair to Senator Yunt. Yes, we should have the ability to get those results that are meaningful to students back sooner. When students take a test, an assessment that looks a lot like an AK Star test called the MAP, those results come back relatively quickly. And they're important. Again, they're not on a scale that's easy to understand. They're numbers in the hundreds of some scale. And you can kind of look at a trend line and see, are you in the green or in the yellow or in the red, right? And so when Blake brings his scores back to me and I know that, he might not want to show me, I know where those are going to be. I can understand that, right? But I know that when he is happy and he's like nailed it, like he's going to show me this trend line that is approaching the green because that's where he's at, right? So those things that are meaningful to students, those results can come back quickly. And we already have a system with MAP and NWEA. They were recently bought out by somebody, but we have the technology.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. I have two questions before I open it to the rest of the committee for additional questions, although I do want to note that we have a budget subcommittee this afternoon, and so I will be cutting us at 5 o'clock just to ensure we can get to that. My first question is particularly about how do you navigate or deal with students with low-incident disabilities? Those students deserve a graduation certificate even if they don't meet proficiency. Nowhere in our Constitution does it say we require students to meet proficiency. We just require to have access to a high-quality education.
Yes. Madam Chair, are you asking about earning a seal of certified proficiency? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to completely answer your question in every case, but I do know that every student who has an IEP or a 504 is given very specific sets of accommodations so that they have the ability to achieve that level. For whatever, wherever they are at. So all accommodations that would be given to a student through the federal law of the IEP and 504, that IDEA law, that they would definitely apply. And some of the testing tools that are available on computers for taking these tests, when students know how to use them, they can be pretty – they're great accommodations.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. It may need some changes in your legislation, as your legislative intent is to ensure all students who graduate from high school achieve proficiency on these areas. And so we might want to create some space to allow for students who have different accommodations to be included in that particular definition. My other question to you, and it's particularly related to Senator Yunt's inquiry, is around the speed in which we might get the results. So one of the things I absolutely adore about the Mat-Su School District, they require every student to take AP seminar and research. There is not necessarily a test that you can provide at the end of that to show that students have learned to think critically or learned to think intensively. It may be a written exam that requires them to write an essay, or it might be something where they provide context for an idea that they have. What is your estimation of how some of these tools might be able to accommodate that hope that we have for our high school students, is their ability to be critical thinkers, not necessarily know what countries are on a map or what the history of the United States is, depending on who is telling the story, but how they can talk and engage with folks in a critical manner?
Thank you for that question, Madam Chair. For the record, Jesse Bjorkman, as we look at this tool is not a panacea or a silver bullet to measure all learning. And that really is where some of the soft skills are grown and cultivated in our schools. And the results of those and that training, they don't wind up in any data. They're immeasurable, right? We talk about draft picks having these like unquantifiable values, right? And so I think as we look at what confirmation tools like these or any assessment are capable of delivering, it's important to understand that it has limits. It has limits to assess proficiency and standards that are written down in paper, and sometimes are super exciting. Sometimes they're not as exciting. But that's the capability of this line of assessments, to deal with the state standards in a way that's meaningful to students themselves. Where soft skills and the ability to think critically, I think, comes in is the habits of mind and nature of being that is required in order to have the discipline necessary to work in groups to maximize learning, that fosters lots of success in education, to work with adults, trusted and respected adults outside of educators, to learn, which often get brought into schools every day, guest speakers, elders, skilled professionals that teach CTE and trades classes. Those are the types of things, and to assess those on a test is rather difficult. But that is why when we do invest in schools and we provide rich exposure in fine arts as well as career and technical education and many other things, those are the things that we invest in, because we can do something a little bit extra aside from reading and writing and math. We enable students to go out and get many of those soft skills that employers value.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. Additional questions? I do want to note we also have Kelly Manning, the Deputy Director of the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence, here with us to walk through the fiscal note, although we might hold that over as we are running a little bit out of time, and there are definitely questions that I have on the particular fiscal note that was provided by the department. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I wonder if you'd help me think through the different requirements for districts based on how many credits a year they offer, and whether we're creating an incentive structure that tries to, that will have the effect, intended or not, of moving districts one way or another.
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, Jesse Bjorkman, for the record, Senator Keel, that incentive structure, if it is being used, already exists, because currently districts, many districts and high schools themselves offer 7 period days. Some high schools within a district will even offer different numbers of periods a day, resulting in different possibilities of earning credits per year. The structure already exists. It just says that currently it could be advantageous for students to be in a system that they can earn more credits sooner. I don't know of any district or school that is intentionally making that choice to offer 7 periods versus 6 to allow more students to gain credits faster, but the ability is there. It just, this change simply says, if you do offer more credits, we would expect the minimum number of credits to be earned to be just a little bit higher. And so one of the things that you could follow through then, if you're interested in what course selection would be available to students, is you take your 4 core areas of study plus your PE and health in your freshman year maybe, and then you say, well, if you have six periods only, you have to make a choice your freshman year typically. Am I going to take a fine arts course or am I going to take a CTE course? That's significantly limiting to schools who only offer 6 periods a day. I personally, as a student, a dad, and an education professional, don't like that model. I think it's restrictive, and I think we can do way more if we offer 7 periods a day. And by the way, we should have longer periods, and we should go to school a little bit longer. It's a different story for a different day.
It's a different bill.
Because it offers a much more rich learning experience. Right now, if you have 6 periods and you have low standards of what your graduation requirements are, you have less learning opportunities and you have a much less diverse educational experience. I don't know that it incentivizes one way or another. I think that provision like levels the playing field, because right now schools are free to offer 7 or even 8 periods a day. And if you offer a credit for every period, you can rack up credits and then have students say, I'm done. faster. And so that's one thing I'm concerned about.
Senator Keel, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, great food for thought. Thank you. I will chew on that. I guess my one concern is that the ability to offer seven periods a day with the same credit requirements can create some flexibility for those students who need to work that afternoon job or have those morning sibling care responsibilities in a single parent household. So I want to think a little bit about requiring more credits total in that situation. But I will also chew on the notion you've given us. Thank you.
President Stevens.
Could you talk a little bit about portfolios? I think I like the idea, but I'm not sure how it fits into the time you have in a school. How does the teacher handle portfolios? It looks like it would be more time-consuming, but maybe I misunderstand.
Yes, that's a great question. Through the chair to Senator Stevens, Jesse Bjorkman, for the record. Yes, it would take additional time, and it would be likely that the testing coordinator at the school, together with the subject area teacher, and probably who really should be most responsible for that is the student themselves to track the portfolio. It's not impossible task. It actually would be a pretty good exercise for many of the students to look at the standards, and then you'd have core standards that you would be measured on as a student who did a portfolio. And so you would just select pieces of work or be able to do certain things that would meet that portfolio requirement. This is done in many realms in education. Some teachers themselves, through their evaluation process every other year, can do a similar thing through their evaluation. If it were me administering this and creating regulations, I would encourage students themselves to be responsible for putting together portfolios with the help of a testing coordinator or some kind of student success liaison that we could do. You are right, though, and your concern is valid that this bill will and should create more cost because nothing's free. Like, nothing's free. And so I would be interested in hearing from districts and building administrators, if we go forward with increasing credit requirements, what kind of staff, like if you take your staff right now and you're building your schedule, what kind of additional staff do you need to meet that scheduling requirement and actually have real numbers? Like, it's so important, I think, when we are looking at policy like this, we have to put those real numbers in place. We would want principals from all over to say, build us a schedule with these requirements, and what do you come up with for staff needs? I think that data, as we look at this process, is something we need. This is not a we're going to pass here in 90 days and then say this is the law. This is a very what you like to say, Madam Chair, and it's interesting. It's a new word that I like, is iterative process that we can go through and find new ways of knowing.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. I am going to hold this bill until a future hearing. We don't have anyone online to testify right now, so at that point we'll also open up public testimony to offer folks an opportunity to chime in. The one thing I just want to note for the record before we move on to our last item of business is that there is no provisions in here for folks who might transfer into a school their senior year, or for folks who might transfer mid-year of their senior year, to ensure that if they have met requirements, they can test out or potentially get this particular endorsement to ensure that they are not missing out on opportunities. With that being said, I'm going to hold this bill. Please work with my office and the bill sponsor if there's any concerns, and we will continue to work on this legislation and iterate as we go. With that being said, we're going to move on to our final item on the agenda. Thank you both for presenting. We will hear Senate Bill 210, Indigenous Cultural Heritage Education. We first heard Senate Bill 210 on February 16th. At that time, we took public testimony. My office has received no amendments. My Ted Stevens legislative intern, Mr. Jason Ritter, is here to provide us a very brief, less than a minute, reminder of what this legislation does.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, very briefly, SB 210 adds...
Who are you?
Oh, for the record... Jason Ritter, staff to Senator Lukey Tobin. It adds language supporting place-based education opportunities in Alaska's public schools with the aim of helping educators serve Alaska Native communities. As part of the policy, school staff would have an understanding awareness of Alaska Native and American Indian tribes, and it would allow staff members to better relate and communicate with Alaska Native students and parents. tribal consultation is already required under the Elementary Secondary Education Act and reauthorized as the Every Student Succeeds Act, and there is a zero fiscal note.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ritter. It is my intention to move Senate Bill 210 from the Education Committee. President Stevens.
Madam Chair, I move to report Senate Bill 210, Work Order 34-LS1190/A from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal zero fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, Senate Bill 210, Work Order 34-LS1190/A, as in ANIAC, is reported from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Please stay behind today's meeting to sign the committee report. This concludes our agenda for today. I want to thank Senator Bjorkman for bringing his bill to us. We will bring it back at a later date just to have a continued conversation and to review the fiscal notes and also have public testimony. For the folks' edification, the Senate Education Committee will not be meeting this Friday. However, we will meet again at 8 a.m. Wednesday, March 11th, in a joint meeting with the House Education Committee to hear from our State Board of Education. Oh, how I love 8 a.m. meetings. That will be in the Davis Committee Room. The next meeting of the Task Force on Education Funding will be this Monday, March 9th. Our topic is major maintenance and construction. We invite everyone to join us for that conversation. That will be at 3:30 p.m. in the Davis Committee Room. As there is no other business before us today, I will adjourn us at 5:01 p.m.